Aloha, friends. My name is Matthew Gray, and welcome to 50 Tastes of Gray. Today's show is for all you hungry folks who ever dreamt about having a restaurant. Or maybe you're just food curious. My esteemed guest, Casey Anton, is a seasoned veteran of the restaurant industry with over 20 years of experience. Casey is the founder of Spark Business Consulting and the author of the highly anticipated book, Profit First for Restaurants. Casey's expertise lies in empowering small business owners to kickstart and sustain successful growth and financial habits using the innovative Profit First system. Her mission, whether it's her clients, listeners, or anyone who enters her sphere, is to help them master their numbers, understand their business model, and build the company of their dreams. With a successful consulting business of her own, Casey's impact is far-reaching. Her success is mirrored in the achievements of her clients, many of whom credit their success to her guidance. To stay current with me and 50 Tastes of Gray, please visit my home at lovelife.com or go over onto YouTube for video nuggets from my shows. So now, please join us in welcoming the remarkable Casey Anton. Hey, Casey, how are you doing?
Very well. How are you?
Good. Thank you for joining me here on 50 Tastes of Gray. I'm really happy to see you.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I dig that background there on the wall. What is that? Is that wallpaper? Is that a mural or what?
It's wallpaper. It's super fun wallpaper. It's zebras with pink mohawks and drunk monkeys and crazy owls. It's just fun. Just makes me smile.
Oh, I love that. It's really cool. Where did you find that?
I found it on Pinterest originally, and I just sent it to my interior designer, and she, you know, researches it. I think it came from England, though.
So let's get the show on the road. What do you say?
Let's do it. I love it.
All right. Well, as you may already know, my first question is, what have you eaten today?
Ooh, today, what have I eaten? I wouldn't say I ate anything because it's a smoothie, so I don't know if you call that. But I spent last weekend researching and creating different smoothies so I could find the perfect blend of all the nutrients that I need to go with this new AG1 powder. It's kind of like all the rage right now, like that I've been using it by itself. Not taste that great. So that's what I was doing all weekend. So actually that is what I had today. I'm having my second one now, but this smoothie, which is just, it's spinach and almond milk and almond butter. Oh my God, it's so good. Banana. And then these two different powders that I use. Ooh. And it's filling and it's delicious. Tastes like a chocolate peanut butter cup, to be honest with you. It's amazing. That's probably my favorite thing right now. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that sounds really good. Now, when you come into the restaurant world and you try to help out with your book, what is the name of your book, by the way?
Profit First for Restaurants.
Okay. That brings up so much, and you're a perfect fit for this broadcast because we're very food forward around here. Mm-hmm. And I've owned restaurants, I've run restaurants, I've been a chef at restaurants and so on. And we all know that the razor thin margins are near impossible, especially in the post-COVID days, for restaurants to put two nickels together, mm-hmm. for restaurants to be able to have training procedures. Many of them don't. And a lot of people just go into the restaurant world thinking, oh, I want to own a restaurant someday because I can make fill in the blank so well. Everybody's told me my whole life I should run a restaurant. So let's address a couple of those issues about people who go into the restaurant business not understanding anything about food, flavor, aroma, architecture, training issues, and so on. So just riff on that for a little while.
Oh, there is so much right there, Matthew. Wow. Okay. Rarely do I come across many restaurants that don't at least have or believe they have one of those components, right? Usually it's going to be a great chef with zero business sense or someone with a great business sense or a decent business sense and has no idea how to cook, but there's something in there. I would say that, first of all, if you've never worked in a restaurant before, you have absolutely no business ever opening one because you just do not know what you don't know. And there's too many moving pieces. But I would say this, I have this unique perspective, right? Because I used to be a restaurateur. I owned and operated restaurants in Boston before I sold. settled down, got married, had my children, and decided to start this little bookkeeping company that then grew into this accounting and now consulting firm where we work with all types of industries, right? So we have different divisions now. Restaurant is my number one division because it is my heart and soul. That's my background. That's probably about 40% of our clients. And then there are other divisions we work in, and we work a lot in the construction, interior design, retail, law firms, screen printers, bridal, cannabis. Here's the thing. Across all of these other businesses, they are just, in my opinion, in my front row seat to thousands of businesses, are way easier to run than a restaurant. There's just less moving parts. They're less living, breathing things like a restaurant is. So it's an all-encompassing, life-changing business that you are going to be completely immersed in. So you better have passion for it. You better absolutely love it. You better have a great team around you, and you have to know your numbers because, as you just said, the margins are so incredibly slim that to get into it and to think that you're going to make money or be profitable, which you have to just to survive anyway, you have to know your numbers. You have to understand that business model so minutely, and you need to know exactly how many you need to sell in order just to break even. And you got to be comfortable with that number. It's got to make sense to you.
Okay, so your approach, it sounds like it's very meticulously crafted around the accounting numbers and the scientific aspects. Is that correct?
Yes. So everything that we do from the consulting and coaching angle is 100% derived from and based in the numbers. And I'll tell you why. One, I think it just makes logical sense. But two, I have come across so many restaurants where I have, you know, they come in, I've met with them for an hour or two, I get into their books, I spend a little time in there, and I say, you have to close. This is never going to work. You are never going to make money. And every minute that you stay open is more debt you're going to incur because your business model is broken and you're upside down. If the numbers don't work, unless you're someone who just wants to be in debt the rest of your life, and I can't imagine anyone being that way, the business doesn't work. So yeah, everything we do starts and ends with the numbers and how they flow through a business. Yep.
Okay, so it sounds like then your clientele are people already in business who are facing some sort of struggle. So they need someone who can kind of identify and drill down on their numbers.
Yeah, about 90%. You just nailed it. That's exactly right. The other 10 are startups. And thank God they come here first. Hey, I have a great idea. I want to open a hotel, a food truck, whatever it is. And as I start, actually, this is the first, like the first paragraph in my book is, I feel like I spend most of my days killing dreams because I usually end up saying, this isn't going to work. The numbers do not work. Which is sad, right? Because I love entrepreneurs. It's what I do for a living, but I'm not going to let them get into something that I know won't work.
What about the creative process and how does that get incorporated into the numbers? Because like I said, before you're a restaurant owner, you're a dreamer who wants mm-hmm. to go into the restaurant world. Those people need a little bit of help. They need some understanding that is really not numbers related. It's more about how am I going to learn completion of having dishes that are going to be on point every time, very consistent. How am I going to learn how to train people? How am I going to learn how to overcome and create? And so there's so much before the numbers start to even play a role in taking you down. Is that any part of your assistance with someone who's in that dreamer stage?
Well, yeah, but I think I would disagree with that is that something happens. The numbers are there the entire time, or they should be. They better be. So there is a process I take my readers or my clients through, which is the, you know, like a business model chapter, but it's really kind of close your eyes, get into the shoes, you know, your best guest, and walk through what they see, hear, smell, taste, through the entire experience that you want to give. So I think for me, that is how I can kind of tap into that creative end that they're coming to me with, because I don't have that whatever side of the brain that is, it's creative. I have the other side. I have the very analytical, very practical side, but I understand and I so appreciate and I love the creative side. That's how I can kind of tap into it with those type of clients where I have them close your eyes and just walk me through. What does it look like? Tell me what you see. And I have this whole process they go through. And while they're doing it, I'm writing down numbers. I'm figuring out what this thing's going to cost the whole time because I'm trying to save them from themselves usually because they'll be like, oh, well, I'm going to offer this and there's going to be chandeliers and we're going to have music. So I'm adding, oh, okay, this is good. Great. Okay. So you're going to break even at about $1 million in sales, like check average of $100 a head. All right. What does that break? How many people, how many seats do you have? So that's where I'm, you know, that's where I come at it. Like I want to bring that creative vision to reality. We both want it. I'm just going to level you down into some reality here of what that's going to take.
Are the things that you're looking at are what their investment availabilities are for putting out dollars and for getting a space and for leasing and knowing how much inventory they need to carry and things along those lines?
Sure, that's a piece of it. That's one piece of it, yeah.
And so how do you deal with it when someone says, we've got $500,000, we want to open up a restaurant, what would be your first step?
If they came and said they had $500,000, great, wonderful. So we're going to be looking at smaller restaurants, which I love. Those are my favorite anyway. I would much rather have a 40-seat restaurant than a 100-seat restaurant myself. So great. We're going to look for an existing restaurant. You're not building from scratch at $500,000. Nowhere that I know is going to do that. So, I mean, it's great. It kind of narrows it down. I'm going to level the playing field with, here's your market. Here's your pool, what we're going to play in right now with $500,000 and what that's going to look like. So usually that's kind of bringing them down a few steps, because depending on the person, they might think that's more money than God and they can do a lot with it. And in the restaurant industry, that's absolutely not, because we got to back out our working capital. We got to back out the lawyer fee. There's so many things. So yeah, they'll come to me with that and we'll put a plan in place. It's one of the services we offer, is to help them write their business plan. Again, that's very much a come to Jesus moment, and making them understand that that $500,000 is not going to go as far as you might think, but it can go somewhere. But let's just get your expectations in check, because it's going to look like this and not like this.
What do you think modern day understanding is of the success level of a new restaurant starting now and post COVID?
I think that there is almost no understanding of it, which is probably why we have so much work. I think there is a lot of, it's impossible, it can't be done. There's a lot of negativity around that, and I hear it all the time.
I was actually referring to the statistics that have to do with the failure rate of restaurants. Something like 80% of new restaurants fail within the first year or 2 years, and the half of the remaining within 3 years, they're gone. And so the success rate is very small.
When I was researching for the book, and I think I looked at about 5 or 6 different places, everyone had a different statistic. It was between 50% and 95%. So it just depends on where you look. And neither one was more credible than the other. They all were credible sources. But for restaurants, it is a very high failure rate. Totally believe it's probably about 80%, like you said.
If you were to guesstimate, Casey, the restaurants that serve alcohol versus the ones that do not usually succeed at a higher level.
If we're talking about the independent, like the single operator independent ones, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm going through in my mind, like, all the whole list of, we have all kinds of restaurants. Oh, yeah, overall. But I think Chipotle is doing okay. I think McDonald's, you know, they don't serve alcohol. Well, at least Chipotle around here doesn't, right? You know, so those like chains, fast food that don't serve, no, I think they're doing just fine. I think they will always do just fine for the most part. But the single, or like the, you know, the less than 5 units, less than 10 units, yeah, I definitely think so. It depends on the model, of course, or the concept, really. I mean, but yeah, overall, absolutely, because people want to go out to eat to celebrate. And part of being celebratory usually can involve having a drink or two. And so it helps.
Are most of your clients the chains that you mentioned, or multi-unit owners, or they're one-offs, or like small mom and pop types?
Yeah. So most of ours are the one-offs. I think the most we have someone who has 5 units. We have someone who has 3 units. So I'd say under 5 units. When they're getting more than that, they usually should have an internal in-house team doing it all. And we're outsourced CFOs. So yeah, we stay with the 5 units and under, but mostly most of them are the single one-offs, and maybe they're looking to open up another one once we can get them straight on the first one.
My understanding is that attendance is down as far as customers and tables. Yeah. I don't know if that's the same everywhere, but my guess is that it is. People are just not going out, and that's for a multitude of reasons. Yep. One is that they cannot afford the restaurant. Two is that the diner's experience often turns into what I call diner's remorse.
What do you mean by diner's remorse? That they had a bad experience?
Even if it wasn't a bad experience, that the food was not so hot and it was expensive, and they know that they could do better in their own kitchen, because I know that people who like to cook like to have nice food when they go out, and quite often you just not get what you're hoping for.
Yeah. So that's such a great question. And I'd say I have a couple of answers. The first one that comes to mind really is, not every restaurant is down in sales, right? Not every, and I'm sure in whatever market that they're in, they could probably think of one or two restaurants that's not, that that's still killing it or beating it. And so I would go in and find out what their secret sauce is. Why are they doing well? What is it about them? There's something. And it doesn't mean like, oh, well, they sell whatever, the best cupcake dessert there ever was. And that's why. Okay. I mean, but there's something in there for that. Okay. So people are going there because they're known for the best desserts. Then why do people come to your restaurant? And can you capitalize on what that is and make it more fun or market more or be out there more about whatever it is that you've heard the feedback from your customers that they love? And let's, first of all, just hope you're getting that feedback, because that's crucial to understand as a restaurateur why people come back to your restaurant, or certainly why they don't, but you want to know why they do. So that would be where I would start the conversation. Is it's a problem. People are not eating out as much overall. Absolutely. I'd say of the 75 or 80 clients we have on board right now, the majority of them are down in sales, but not all of them. And it's the ones that aren't, the ones that are matched or higher, because they were innovative during COVID and beyond. They have really tapped into, what is it that my guests want? Why are they coming back? How do I give them more of that? So that's one piece of it. Another piece of it is to almost just, you know, repackage what they're already doing. And what I mean by that, and this can be key for a lot of the more the takeout oriented type of businesses or restaurants, is one of our initial clients that I started with about 12 years ago is called Wicked Good Cupcakes. And she started as a cupcake bakery here just south of Boston, and not doing great. I was with her. I was in the shop with them a couple of days a week trying to help. She ended up being a friend of mine. Wasn't doing well. But she decided she was going to put these cupcakes in jars, mason jars, like pretty jelly jars, mason jars. And she did it so it looked kind of nice. And then she started doing it that way and, you know, picked up a little bit of business, but not enough to keep them in business. But what happened was she took one on a flight and the TSA pulled her aside, didn't let them take the cupcake, pulled it apart, and she was able to kind of take some pictures and talk to them about it. And they literally thought there was a bomb in a jar. But that she was smart enough to contact CNN and had all of these stories go on about, you know, a cupcake is a bomb in a jar. And anyway, that alone kind of helped to blow her up. So now she became the cupcake in a jar queen. And so that was so easy, because now you're selling them online. They're easy to package. They're delightful. They're customizable. And they just sold to Hickory Farms 2 years ago for, now they're retired, to be honest with you. So to go from a little bakery that was not going to make it to the business that they grew out of that, which was amazing. And she didn't invent the cupcake. She did not invent that. She invented a new way to package it. And that's all it took.
Aside from that hugely viral story, it is pretty cool. But if someone is expecting to fly a banner across the sky or get stopped by TSA or going viral in any other kind of news fashion, for the rest of us, they're just trying to get by. Have you noticed that many of them have, there's this nexus between people coming in your restaurant and getting the food to the people. And now in the post-COVID world, people want food brought to their house. So restaurants are partnering with companies like Uber and DoorDash, and those companies have a reputational issue because they're really technology companies. They're not food companies. And there are a lot of issues with that as far as delivery. And it's busting the balls of all the restaurants who are hiring them. Delivery costs and the fees and the charges and the upcharges and whatever is hurting everybody, except perhaps the customer who's getting cold food brought to their door. So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I just wrote a piece on this as well. I would say over the last few years, other than the prime costs, food and beverage costs, and labor, the next biggest line item, usually it's occupancy. It has been these DoorDash type fees. I could not believe what I saw. And so, but as you were just mentioning, it's sort of a necessary evil in a way, right? Because it didn't make sense for them to have drivers, depending on the restaurant, that they have on staff, right? And plus DoorDash, you know, is one app that everyone goes to, and then they'll be able to pick their restaurant versus just going on Google. So I get it in terms of a necessary evil, but it got to a point where they were going to lose money every time someone ordered from them on DoorDash, right? And that doesn't make any sense. And I think that I'd love to drive that home, that point home with more restaurateurs, because I feel like their thought process is, well, at least it's cash flow. Cash flow is great, but not if it's negative. So this is negative cash flow. So what I've started to talk about with some of my clients is, well, one, you can negotiate with some of them. If they haven't already tried to negotiate with Uber Eats, DoorDash, or whatever, there is room there. I'm not going to say they're going to say yes to you, but we have had some luck with our clients dropping those fees in half, which were still high, but it was doable. So that's one. Secondly, they would need to, if they're going to participate in that, they can't absorb those type of fees. So they need to figure out what they're going to price on those and the items they're going to sell through DoorDash. So to make it work, let's say you might need to have an 18% food cost in order to be able to sell it appropriately and be able to afford the fees. So there's like some modeling to do in there on what you're going to sell on these online delivery services site so that you're not being stuck with a negative bottom line from them, what you might offer to someone coming into your restaurant. So I'd be very careful in understanding their menu costs when it comes to that. And the last thing is, as much as we all love delivery, and we do, and it's a huge market and that's not going to go away. I even do delivery, so I get it. But I think some people, at least in my genre, whether it's working moms and we're just too tired, we need dinner on the table. I would say there's a lot more to be done with family style food. And I would even be willing, and I know this is true for others, to go pick it up if there's something in it for me to do so. So for example, Domino's Pizza tried that, like, oh, we'll pay you to come pick it up, where they were tipping the customer. That was a huge marketing campaign they did on commercials, right? Which really they were giving you maybe $2 off your pizza, but they called it a tip to the customer, right? That was just trying. I mean, I get it. They were incentivizing people to stop using their drivers and to come in and pick it up. I don't see many other places doing that. And I think if you're an independent, small restaurant, there's room for you to make it worth my while to want to go stop at your restaurant if I'm going to pick up family style service, if maybe there's going to be a little extra, maybe some cookies, I don't know, maybe gamify it and give me some rewards, something in it for me, then you don't need to use DoorDash. If I know I can count on you to put this together, I'll still pay you for it. You'll make a higher margin because it's family style. And then you make it a surprise to kind of gamify it for me and my kids. I'd be all about it.
That's brilliant because they're ruining the reputation of takeout and takeaway and delivery food. A lot of times delivery food gets plopped on your doorstep. They don't ring the bell. It smells of smoke as if the driver might have been smoking in his car with your food. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I think it's a big fail. I think it's hurting restaurants. And now I'm learning that the DoorDashes and the Uber Eats and companies of that nature are starting to list restaurants on their site that haven't signed up with them. So they get the call for a to-go order from a certain restaurant. Then they communicate that to the restaurants, like take it or leave it. That's hurting the industry, I think.
It's terrible. I didn't even know that was actually happening. No, and I can't believe they can get away with that. Wow.
They're getting away with it, unfortunately. Wow. Let's shift gears for a second.
Okay.
If I was having a dinner party and I invited you and your hubby to come to it, what would be, and it was a potluck, what would you prepare and bring to
you? Well, I would ask you, of course, as a good guest. For some reason, I'm coming up with sangria to start because I do make a really gorgeous, gorgeous red sangria. It has like this nice caramel. It's a beautiful thing. So I think I would want to bring that in a beautiful pitcher, maybe even bring some glasses as a host gift. Then, you know what? It wouldn't be charcuterie. I'm not doing that. I've tried my hand. I'm just not good at the artsy stuff. So I'm not going to bring charcuterie. I think I would probably go right to the entree, and I'm going to think, let's say I'm going to do some type of savory stew or a roast. I think I'll bring the main course. That's kind of where I shine in the savory department. Barely rich, intense, lush flavors is kind of my thing.
That's a great sounding start. Do you cook with a lot of wine and tomatoes, things that are alcohol soluble flavors?
Yep, I do. Yeah.
Okay, I want to get back to that sangria for a second. Do you use spirits in your sangria?
I do, yeah.
Could you give us a little tip as to some of the ingredients you use?
Sure. Let's see.
Sangria recipes with Casey.
Yes, exactly. God, there's so many different ones. I would say if I'm thinking of a winter one, which I don't know why, because we're coming out of winter, but for some reason I'm thinking of a winter one. Let's see. I'd start with a bottle of a red, and it would be a fruity red, maybe a Merlot, or maybe more likely a red blend of some kind, which is usually the cheaper ones you can get, maybe for $6 or $7 at the liquor store. I would start with that, a nice big over the top red blend wine. Then I'm going to add a brandy to it. And I don't have a particular one that actually I can think of. I'm trying to picture my bar at home.
Would it be a typical brandy or a fruit brandy?
A typical brandy. Because I'm not looking to add the fruit. I'm looking to add that butterscotchness really to okay. it, kind of like a butterscotchy thing to it. And then I would add, for my fruit, I'd add a little bit of triple sec. I would definitely add that. Other thing, sometimes I'll add also a flavored vodka to it as well. It kind of depends on who the audience is, but there's every flavor under the sun of vodka right now, right? So you could almost choose and play with it. But I would add a little bit of a flavored vodka. And then that's pretty much, I want to say, all of the alcohol part that would be in it. Of course, I'm going to chop up a ton of fresh fruit, and that needs to sit in that for at least an hour, if not longer. Mm-hmm. And then to finish it off, to be honest with you, I am more of a fan of adding either a ginger beer or a ginger ale to it. I just love that added flavoring. It kind of gives a nice lushness to it as well.
That sounds good. Not for children.
No. Oh, God, no.
Another food question. Do you eat cold pizza?
I have not since I left college, but I used to.
Okay. Yeah. Very safe. Very good. I like that.
Yeah.
I have a thing. I often ask friends and guests that same question. So you just split it right down the middle. That's perfect.
Yeah. I don't even have anything against it. It's just that I have, as an adult with a home and a microwave, I think I would, or actually I use a pizza stone. I would throw it in there for a minute because I like the crispiness, the crunchy of it.
Mm-hmm. If you were a kitchen appliance, what appliance would you be?
They're all going through my head right now, but what is my favorite one? A ricer.
Good. You can tell that I'm not following a script here. So sometimes the questions just come out.
Yeah. I love my ricer. I think I would be that.
So you do a lot of potato.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
If you were to choose one type of cuisine to eat, what would it be and why?
American. I mean, just because I'm such a meat and potatoes girl.
Okay.
And always have been. And it's my go-to, steak and potato. It's just, that's my go-to. But I have to say, right underneath that is a strong Mediterranean. I am half Lebanese, but I didn't get introduced to that side of my family until I was almost 20. And then I started to learn about Lebanese food and Mediterranean food. And now I can't make it. It's just too complex, or I haven't really tried. But I love it. I love everything Mediterranean. Oh, love it.
Okay. Back into your arena. What do you think of the whole tipping awkwardness that's going on these days, and how can we overcome that?
Yeah. Why is that even a thing?
It became a thing. And not only is it awkward at restaurants, but now every time you go through any supermarket or takeaway or whatever, they have those little tablets that are asking you, would you like to round up, or how much would you like to tip the person who just poured your coffee? So there's a lot of that stuff going on. How does that affect you?
For me, it doesn't affect me. And I think why it's become kind of an awkward, weird thing that's been going on is I think that when you're presented with that, hey, would you like to leave a tip for something that seems like that shouldn't be tip worthy, right? People feel obligated, right? Like, oh God, I don't feel the obligation at all. So for me, it's just like no tip. If I don't think, I just make the decision right there. And I feel like if everybody made that decision, I'm not going to tip the Target cashier or whatever it is, then eventually it'll just go away, right? Then, okay, there'll be no tipping for that anymore. I think we, as the consumers, set the precedence. I don't mind tipping my coffee girl. You'd mentioned coffee only because, and I never used to, but they have it, when they see my car pull up, they have it ready for me exactly the way I like it with the sleeve on. They're so sweet. Here you go, Casey, here's your coffee. I'm going to tip for that because I love that service. If I go into a new place where they don't know me, whatever, and I'm just getting a coffee and the service isn't even that great or whatever, and they're just going through the motions, I'm just not going to tip. And I have no guilt about that whatsoever. And I just feel like if that was more of the thought process, tip when you feel it's necessary and don't when you don't, and don't feel bad about it, then everything will fall into place. But I just think it's people's, I don't know, the stories they're telling themselves about tipping, it's getting a little bit crazy out there. I do not think tipping should go away for the restaurant business because they rely on that for their staff to make money. And if tipping goes away and now they have to pay their staff that minimum wage and above, more and more restaurants will go out of business because there's just not money to do that unless you want to now pay $98 for your steak that's $62. I mean, nobody's going to want to pay that. They're already upset about the food prices. I am on board with tipping. I feel like it shouldn't go anywhere. I hope it doesn't go anywhere. I think it's gotten out of control, but I think it's up to the consumers to put that back to its place.
I think you're an outlier, someone who thinks the way you do. I think most people feel awkward, and I think it's getting worse.
I know.
And so that's a big issue. And take myself, for instance, having run restaurants, been a chef and all of that, And now I'm just like a simple, regular guy, consumer-wise, and a former business owner. I paid my people well, and guess what? They gave great service, and they stuck with my company for a long time. These other places that pay people minimum wage, or worse, $2.16, mm-hmm. and they expect me as their customer to pay the wages of their employee who's just like, you know, nothing too special going on there. And then they expect the tip to happen. Doesn't seem like a good way to go. I mean, we're nothing like the way the Europeans are, where people do it for careers. They get paid well. They stick around. There's loyalty. But we're not getting it here. What I'm really trying to say is that I think that employers should pay employees well, a living wage, and not rely upon the customers to pay it for them.
In the restaurant industry, where yeah. will they pull that money from?
I don't know, baby. If you want to go into a business, you got to take care of your people. That's the way it is. It's like you're creating a team.
I 100% agree with that. I don't know a model of a restaurant that it could be a casual restaurant or just not. That's not uber fine dining that would be able to right. do that and keep their prices in line to actually have customers come back on a regular basis and do that.
Do you think that's a cultural thing here in the United States and North mm-hmm. America, let's say, versus in Europe where small places do pay their people well and they can exist?
I think it's a cultural thing, definitely is. Yeah. But I also think it's a, well, you said cultural, I mean, culture thing in terms of, because right. you'd mentioned, well, you're going to pay Billy $2.63 an hour as the tipped wage and, you know, hope that he does a decent job and maybe make some tips. But that's not the type of culture I would ever run in my restaurant. I would want everyone to be hospitality minded or they're not going to work for me. Right. So and you make that as part of your culture on every single pre-service, which I hope you will have a pre-service every day. I would never run my restaurant without a pre-service. It's the way that it's our pregame. It's the way we get amped up. It's the way that we celebrate each other. And then that then spills over into the guest service. And so the tips would just start flowing in because we're there to serve and we love doing it. I think if you do all that, then everything will just work magically in the way it should happen. But in terms of someone who's not going to have that type of culture and just hires anyone off the street and says, oh, I hope you make decent tips. Ugh, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. When I was doing pre-service all those years, it was about education. Making sure my people knew where my food was sourced, how it was prepared, what ingredients were in it, all the important things that a restaurant reviewer or someone who really understands food would be asking.
I did some of that as well. But now that I think culture is so important, I'm coaching my clients more on having that as part of exams, quizzes, a separate staff meeting where that you're going to learn the food, you're going to learn where it's sourced, you're going to learn everything about that separately, and keep the pre-service as literally the huddle that you see where all the players are jumping around and patting each other on their back, and keep it about celebration and get that energy through the roof. Throw on some music, have a 60-second dance party, just more about like the connection and the joy. And that will then spill over in terms of a pre-service meeting. Just make it about fun and excitement and what you want your guests to feel from the minute they step into the minute they leave your restaurant. I'm just finding they're getting more buy-in that way from their staff than making it all educational. Although there is always an educational component to it. I just think that could also be separate.
Very interesting. And it's a good approach. Absolutely. And speaking of team meetings and so on, have you ever watched the show called The Bear?
All of it. Yeah. I've watched every episode.
How do you think that represents restaurants and interpersonal relationships within the industry?
Well, I think it's exactly, there was nothing that was dramatic about it. It was exactly what I have seen in the 25 years I was in the industry. It was very, very accurate. As a matter of fact, I remember I had to stop watching it for a while and before I went back to it because of the angst. It brought me back to that place of the stress. And And it was crazy. Like I just felt it in my chest. Like, oh my God, it was a lot. And then I had to step away. And then I came back with like, okay, breathe, Casey. Like you're not there anymore. And it's not hearts and lungs. We're serving dinner. And I wanted to tell them that on the show, right? Yeah. But that is very, very much how I'd say your average restaurant, if not more, than operates. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And if I was consulting restaurants right now, I'd have that be part of their homework.
Yeah. Yeah.
Watch this show.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
What are you doing as far as promoting and pitching the book? Tell us a little bit more about what restaurant operators and people who are interested in the industry would want to know about your book and what you're doing.
Yeah. So I wrote the book. I mean, Profit First itself is the best-selling business book. Came out 10 years ago. It sold well over 1 million copies and is all around the world. So I just wrote the derivative of one, Profit First, for restaurants. So I took the core concepts that have changed, you know, changed businesses across the world. I think over 300,000 are doing this Profit First, just a cash management system. It's actually quite simple. And I designed it specifically for restaurants. And then within the book, it wasn't just about the math. It was, there are case studies and my story, and it's all weaved in and out of the book. And so I would say, if anyone out, I'd say anyone who just has a restaurant, but whether you're struggling or you're thinking of starting up or wherever you're at, it is great. It's just a great book to read about what other businesses all across the U.S. have done. I have success stories and I have two failure stories in there as well, which my editor asked me to leave out. And I would not, because I think it was really important for people to see the ones that don't work and why they don't work, because it might be you. And then I touch on every single aspect of the restaurant. And I think that based on the reviews I'm getting and just, you know, I poured my heart and soul into that for 2 years of writing before it announced. And I just feel like it's really helping to change restaurants across the country and the world, actually, because New Zealand and Australia really seemed to like the book, which I was surprised when they started reaching out to me. And it's for anyone who's ever been in the restaurant business. It reads like a story. But there are so many actionable steps that you can take, even just baby steps. And then there's 10 steps that you can take. And there's no doubt in my mind that it will change your business for the better. There's no doubt in my mind. There's something for everyone. There's a marketing piece, but mainly it has to do with making sure that you have a business model that works, what it looks like when it works, and then what to do with the money to make sure it works. And it's just great. So it's available anywhere. It's Profit First for restaurants. And what I'm loving now, it only came out last summer, is that now that I think people have bought it and have read it, I'm just, over the last couple of months, I'm starting to get all the Instagram messages, and they always go in the block, so I have to go find them. But I've gotten at least this last month a dozen messages from people who are just saying, this, your book completely changed everything for me. I love the part about this, or I love the part about that, or I never thought of it this way. Or even last week, it was a gentleman who said, I knew what you were saying. Like, he had one part of his business was not doing well, and it was sucking all the profit from the ones that were. It was robbing Peter to pay Paul all day long, which happens a lot when you try and run too many places. And he said, I knew it and I just didn't want to face it. But the way you phrase it, it made me face it. And now look what I'm going to do. And we're going to close it. And now these other two are going to flourish. And he's like, I don't know why I didn't do it, but your book made me see it the way I needed to see it. And it was just awesome. I mean, it's just awesome to see how it's helping people.
Isn't it nice to get a little bit of engagement, have people acknowledge you for what you've done?
It's everything, that it's just that it's helping them. And I think the reason why we've done so well here at Spark, this is the company, the consulting company that I own, is because from day one, for me and my 10 employees, we're just here to serve. And if I could do it for free, I would do this for free all day long. I love what we do. We're here to be of service, just to help entrepreneurs build the business of their dreams. That's our mission. Mm-hmm. That has always been our mission. So when we go into every client just with that, with money aside, profit aside, we're just here to help you and fix this business and make it the way you want to be. I think that's why we've grown exponentially. And that's what I did with the book. So when I get that feedback, it's just like, I succeeded because that's what I wanted to do.
You're very left brain. Do you work with a right brain person as an associate or colleague so you guys can go in there with both barrels?
Two, exactly. My marketing director completely is. And then one of my lead accountants, she's the one that works in bridal and interior design and in the cannabis too, but she works in bridal and interior design. And it's because of that, because she can speak their language. I speak restaurant speak all day long. And that's why it's our biggest division and we have the biggest team over there. But her division is, it's like a different planet, but she speaks it. And so they love her. And so, yeah, right. She speaks the bridals. Yeah.
Good. I had a sense about that. Tell us where people can find you. Do you have a website or the name of your podcast that you'd like to share?
Oh, yeah. So my main business, you can find everything right there, is Spark Business Consulting. So Spark as in spark plug, businessconsulting.com. And from there, you can find our book, or you can find it on Amazon, Profit First for Restaurants, available wherever books are sold. And then I had just recently started my podcast, and they're just snack size, bite-sized pieces of just information or tidbits to give to people. So if you're driving from home to the kitchen or whatever you're doing, there's something in there you can say, I might that's interesting. I might actually think about that or look at that. So they're only 15 to 20 minute episodes, but every single one of them should have something for you. And that's called No Reservations. And that is, again, available wherever you find your podcasts.
Oh, No Reservations reminds me of Bourdain.
It does. I know, yeah. I quote him throughout the book. He was one, and I actually got to meet him years ago too.
Did you?
When I was in New York City, and it was yeah. I mean, looking back, it was a very fun guy. But yeah, so No Reservations, because I don't really hold back anyway. So that's where it came from. Like, I'll pretty much say whatever's on my mind about anything. So I'm like, I'm not going to hold back. There's no reservations.
Casey, thank you so much for joining me today on 50 Tastes of Grey. This is good, important information people should know about.
Thank you, Matt. This was awesome. I really appreciate it. I love talking to you. I could talk about this stuff all day long.
I can tell, and we'll have to do that again. Casey, I want to say aloha to you. And thank you so much once again for joining me.